Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thank you for joining the program tonight. We appreciate it. It is 7 past the hour. I guess you've heard by now, BP has been lying their asses off all day. The attempt to inject mud into this wellhead was suspended at midnight last night. So what we have been seeing on these video monitors, I don't have a clue, except it is mud and gas and oil being forced out of the holes and rips and tears in this thing. Listen, we're in a world of trouble here. We really are. There was a second round of mud attempt, this injection attempt, but it was suspended. Pumping operations, according to, what's the guy's name, Suttles, Doug Suttles, Chief Operating Officer for BP. A second round is to begin this evening sometime. Suttles said at this press briefing that occurred after the stock market closed, it was around 6 o'clock tonight, he said, "I would say I actually believe this can work, but until we've completed the work, it's difficult to be optimistic or pessimistic." Well, maybe for you, pal. That's because you are a lying son of a bitch who is paid to get out here and lie and lie and lie. So what's the video showing? Is it a fake? Is it leaking mud plug or something? Yeah, of course. Now, the really horrific news on top of the merely horrific news today was the fact that it's been discovered a second oil flume under the surface of the ocean. And this one is a monster. It's a monster. It is 22 miles long by 6 miles wide and 3,300 feet thick. And this is the second one. The first one, I don't completely remember, but I think it was three miles. You remember what it was?
Oh, what is that, the size of Manhattan?
Damn near. The first one, I think, was 3 miles by a mile and about 1,000 feet thick. 22 miles long, 6 miles wide, and 3,300 feet thick of oil. You know, when I first saw a comparison of that, these two flumes, it's just staggering. It's just staggering. And they can be more. Now, the reality is they're going to be more. You know, even if they got this thing capped, which it appears they're not going to be able to do until millions more gallons have been released because of this tremendous pressure that they're trying to overcome. Even if they got it capped, the damage now to the Gulf of Mexico, I guess in terms of your lifetime, my lifetime, our kids' lifetimes, we can say this is permanent damage. This is it. If you made trips to the, I believe it's the largest estuary system marsh system in the continental United States, and that's the Gulf, the Mississippi Gulf, or the Gulf area, the Florida Panhandle, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and around to Texas. If you've ever been there, and I have spent an awful lot of time there over the last 20 years, you know that it is more than just a beach to go to or to hang out. It's more than just a fishing industry, although both those are extremely important. This is a heartbeat. This is a life force for not just the United States, but all these migratory birds from South America, from Canada. Everything is being poisoned. It's all being poisoned. And is it not clear now that BP had no idea, and still doesn't, what it was doing? Which begs the question, do any of these capitalistic, corporatist oil companies have any idea what they're doing? Punching holes 5, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 feet down under the surface of the ocean. To this point, the top kill or the mud injection to overcome the pressure from this oil reserve under sea is simply not working. It is not working. Bruce writes, don't worry, it will work. Mud pumping will work when the pressure drops enough. Well, yeah. In other words, wait for the dragon to die of old age, then run out from the castle and take credit for killing it. The dragon has already killed all the villagers. Yeah, I get the point, Bruce. Yeah.
I think one of the things that bothers me the most about this is the attitude that BP displays of just, we can do anything we want, even at this point, since they've poisoned the earth. And let me just pause and say, I hope all that plume of oil ends up gushing all over Rush Limbaugh's mansion when the hurricane picks it up.
No, you really don't mean that, because it's not going to go into that rat bastard's house or beach exclusively. No, don't say
just,
that.
If it could just
I know you're frustrated like everybody else is, but no, we don't.
But it's the attitude of BP of just, even at this point of, oh, well, we can just, smite the press and the public for another, and just lie for 16 hours and pretend everything might be working. And meanwhile, we've stopped operation. And what are they feeding us? A video loop of something? I mean, there's,
what we're seeing is a section of this drilling operation that is not obviously, I think it's obvious now, this is not the wellhead that we've been looking at. This is an adjunctive part of all the equipment that they have down there. This is not, unless I'm mistaken, this is not the primary wellhead. We're not watching the oil coming up out of the earth there. What we're watching is a section of a pipe. I'm sure Bruce or Michael will let me know if that's wrong. But no, we've been watching something real. It's just not, it's not been real in terms of stopping this monster. So there's only one conclusion here. And that is that we are right now witnessing the first steps, the first part of a total environmental collapse that nobody has any idea at this point how big it is. Is it going to be confined to destroying the southern United States? Is it going to be confined to destroying these estuaries and wetlands? Is it going to be confined to swinging around the east coast of the United States and destroying everything up the coast? Is it going to be confined to then floating across the Atlantic and destroying the coasts of France and Spain and England and Wales and Ireland? And you know, is it going to continue? This could be what Jacques Cousteau warned us about.
Scream, you suppress, embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. All right, Kathy wants me to read this. It's not in order of what I was going to do here, but let's see what we've got. It's from Tim. And he writes, maybe you saw on Democracy Now or from other sources that BP hasn't been allowing respirators for cleanup crews inhaling all the chemicals, not only from the oil, but especially the dispersants, because of industry experience after Exxon Valdez. Respirators mean a dangerous condition, and admitting the conditions are actually dangerous. And admitting the conditions are actually dangerous would open BP to huge liability claims. A representative of the Shrimpers Association of Louisiana with extensive experience in the petroleum industry made note on Democracy Now! This morning of all the very deadly chemicals that are now in the waters of the Gulf. The headlines this AM were that the top kill was working. Now the headlines say that BP had to shut down and is going to resume tonight. If the administration is supposed to be in control, who's doing the news releases to the news organizations, the administration or BP? Clearly, the news people are being lied to on a regular basis from BP and the government. I don't see the Obama administration taking control of the situation. I don't know if they can at this point. Tim in Grand Junction, Colorado. Yeah, I've been seeing that that bit of video about seven or eight people had to be taken to the hospital who were working on recovery, oil recovery, I think. I'm still trying to get my mind around a lake of oil, 22 miles long, 6 miles wide, and 3,300 feet thick. Jesus God, heading where? Heading to Mobile Bay, Mobile, Alabama. You know, the idea, Kathy's talking to my headphones here, the idea of no respirators to limit liability claims. Well, of course, if you listen to this program and you hear me talk about the predatory bastards, these capitalists who have destroyed the family, who have destroyed the hopes and the dreams of God knows how many families, millions of families in this country. They've destroyed the environment. They've destroyed our education system. They've destroyed everything because they took control, full control of the government, slowly but surely, like colon cancer or something, over the past 30, 35, 40 years. They destroyed everything. This is what capitalism does. This is it. They don't care. Well, we got to limit our liability. We're here to make a profit. And if we have people wearing respirators, well, then Jesus God, that'll be more lawsuits. Just like in the mining industry. Just like in the nuclear industry. Just like in every predatory capitalistic industry. You name it. Whether it's here, it doesn't make any difference what country it's in. Over and over and over again. And before you conservative bastards send me an email about, oh, you're a socialist. Look, bite me. Get off my radio program. Go away. All of you are going to just choke to death on your own bile. I don't know why you don't get that, you fools. You fools. And tonight, you know what's going on in the Congress tonight? You know what's going on in Washington? Do you know what's... They're about to take a vote on whether or not to deep six. Don't ask, don't tell. That's the priority in this country with these filthy pigs in the United States Congress voting on whether or not gays should be officially allowed to serve in the military. Gays have been in the military since Alexander the Great, since Genghis Khan, you freaks. Long? 3,300 feet deep? Listen, you can hear it. This is it's a murder machine. Courtesy of BP, courtesy of capitalism, courtesy of Dick Cheney, courtesy of the whole goddamn situation. Huh? I know you right wingers. Go vote for some teabaggers.
Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
It's 25 before the hour. Not that all of this is that filthy bastard Dick Cheney's fault, but Bush and Cheney left a monster. They really did. They just left a monster by gutting what few regulations were left. This is not, you know, Bush and Cheney weren't in office back in 1979 when there was a big spill also in the Gulf of Mexico. That, you know, but what they have done is make sure that, and again, let me back up, oil drilling of any sort results in these kinds of disasters. This is not an anomaly. This is the norm. This is normal. It's only this time it is so horrendous, so huge, so destructive. The energy companies couldn't care less. They don't care. Capitalism doesn't care. Writing at alternate.org, Daniela Perdomo, 10 things you need but don't want to know about the BP oil spill. Number nine is the one that got me. Number nine is environmental damage could even include a climatological catastrophe. She writes, it's hard to know where to start discussing the environmental damage caused by Deepwater Horizon. Each day will give us a clearer picture of the short-term ecological destruction. But environmental experts believe the damage to the Gulf of Mexico will be long-term. In the short term, environmentalists are up in arms about the dispersants being used to clean up the oil slick in the Gulf. Apparently, the types BP is using aren't all that effective in dispersing oil and are pretty high in toxicity to marine fauna such as fish and shrimp. The fear is that what BP may be using to clean up the mess could, in the long term, make it worse. On the longer-term side of things, there are signs that this largest oil drilling catastrophe could also become the worst natural gas and climate disaster. The explosion has released tremendous amounts of methane from deep in the ocean. And research shows that methane, when mixed with air, is the most powerful, in other words, terrible, greenhouse gas, 26 times worse than carbon dioxide. Our warming planet just got a lot hotter. Number 10, no one knows what to do, and it will happen again. She writes, the very worst part about the Deepwater Horizon calamity is that nobody knows what to do. We don't know how bad it really is because we can't measure what's going on. We don't know how to stop it. And once we do, if we do, we won't know how to clean it up. BP is at the helm of the recovery process, but given its corporate track record, its efforts will only go so far. It has a board of directors and shareholders to answer to, after all. The U.S. government, the only other entity that could take over, is currently content to let BP hack away at the problem. Why? Because it probably has no idea what to do either. Here's the reality of the matter. For as long as offshore drilling is legal, oil spills will happen. Coastlines will be decimated, oceans destroyed, economies ruined, lives lost. Oil companies have little to no incentive to prevent such disasters from happening, and they use their money to buy government regulators' integrity. Deepwater Horizon is not an anomaly. It's the norm. Jesus, God. GR in Arizona writes, BP and its people and contractors knew all along the only way to control this oil well is drilling a relief well to divert the oil into a fresh hole. The only issue in the mind of BP is how to damage control it from a PR standpoint while the three-month relief well operation gets done. They always knew it would be a runaway well for 3 months. They always knew that. Tonight, BP's Doug Suttles, CEO, said that the company's top kill operation is proceeding according to the plan we put in place. You son of a bitch. At a news conference tonight, Suttles acknowledged that BP's engineers had paused in their pumping of heavy mud into the well about a mile below the surface. But he indicated that was part of the plan, since it was important to measure the pressure in various parts of the well and equipment to make sure the pumping was having the desired effect. Engineers stopped pumping mud just before midnight and intend to resume pumping this evening, said Suttles. The New York Times report made it sound like the pumping was paused because too much of the drilling mud was escaping with the oil and gas. But Suttles clearly wanted to leave the impression that the stoppage was intended and not driven by any unexpected setbacks. Lying bastard. Go to NewYorkTimes.com and it's right there on their website, the update of this decision and why it was made to stop the mud injection. And it stopped last night or midnight. And all day today, what did you see every time you turned on television? What did you see? You saw that hideous, those hideous flumes of brown stuff coming out of three holes, right? Isn't that what you saw? Just enormous clouds. And then on screen, you would have the anchors or the news readers or their guests or the experts sitting there talking about that thing that was occurring on screen as if that, and discussing it. Well, does that look like more mud or is that more oil? Well, it looks like more mud. Well, it looks like, you know, maybe it's working. Well, they're getting a, and they had stopped the process last midnight. Greg in Florida, Mike, I've got a piece, and I'm going to share this with you in a minute. He writes for the Orlando Independent Examiner, a piece on the latest in the Gulf. The top kill failed. Another giant plume discovered, and an oil industry investor saying there is another larger leak that we're not being shown or told about. One of your callers mentioned that last night. The weird thing is that I've got all the information from corporate media. Does that mean this is so bad there's no hiding it anymore? I listened to the podcast from yesterday, and you seemed a little beaten down and subdued by all of this. I know the feeling. Yeah. So Greg writes for the Orlando Independent Examiner. I'll start this and pick it up after the break. He writes, New York Times reported today that BP's top kill effort has been halted due to a snag. A snag? Perhaps that's a reference to the estimated 170,000 pounds per square inch of pressure that is blowing oil and natural gas from the floor of the Gulf like a volcano. And now also blowing out the drilling mud that BP is attempting to inject in the opening to seal it. The top kill procedure has never been attempted in the deep sea under such enormous pressure. Keep in mind that the water pressure at the depth of the leak is enough to crush the hull of a Navy submarine. Yet oil and gas is shooting out like a geyser. Drilling mud is comprised of divided heavy material such as bentonite and barite and is commonly used in surface operations by being pumped through the drill pipe during rotary drilling to seal off porous zones and flush out chippings. It was not designed for underwater use at such a depth. A live video feed of the operation clearly showed the mud being blasted out of the pipe. But with enough mud being pumped in at a fast enough rate, the hope is that eventually enough mud will accumulate to overcome the upward pressure. Apparently, that has not been the case, and BP halted the procedure, quote, when engineers saw that too much of the drilling fluid they were injecting into the well was escaping along with the leaking crude oil, end quote. That's from the Times. Meanwhile, scientists from aboard the University of South Florida vessel, the Weatherbird 2, used sonar and other devices to sample the water below it. Their findings are frightening, adding to fears that much of the BP oil spill's impact is hidden beneath the surface. According to the Washington Post, an area of dissolved oil was found that is about 6 miles wide and extends from the surface down to a depth of 3,200 feet, said Professor David Hollander. The discovery is the second significant undersea plume recorded since the deep water exploded on April 20th. Hollander said that he believed this plume might have stretched more than 20 miles from the site of the leak on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. It has not yet reached Florida. Hollander said, quote, here's a situation where unless you're looking at the chemical fingerprints, the oil is absolutely not visible. It's not some Italian vinaigrette or anything like that. It's absolutely, perfectly clear. But Hollander said even this clear-looking water could contain enough oil to be toxic to animals at the base of the Gulf food chain. We'll be right back.
Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody.
watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's More Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Back to what Greg Payton wrote for the Orlando Independent Examiner. Okay, 20 miles by 3 miles by 3,200, or 6 miles wide, 20 miles, what do we have, Kathy? 22 miles long, 3,200 feet deep. Back to what Greg wrote, the Washington Post continues to point out that this discovery seems to confirm the fears of some scientists that because of the depth of the leak and the heavy use of chemical dispersants, this oil is behaving differently from others. Instead of floating on top of the water, it may be moving beneath it. The first such plume detected by scientists stretched from the well southwest toward the open sea, but this new undersea oil cloud is headed miles inland into shallower waters where many fish and other species reproduce. It would be troubling because it could mean the oil would slip past coastal defenses such as containment booms designed to stop it on the surface. Already scientists and officials in Louisiana have reported finding thick oil washing ashore despite the presence of these floating booms. In yet another troubling development, Matt Simmons told Dylan Radigan on MSNBC, I guess today, that, quote, there's another leak, much bigger, 5 to 6 miles away from the leaking riser and blowout preventer shown on the underwater cameras. Simmons was an energy advisor to George W. Bush, an advisor to the Oil Depletion Analysis Center, and a member of the National Petroleum Council and the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also chairman and CEO of Simmons & Company International, an investment bank catering to oil companies. In other words, news of this second leak comes from a source who has inside knowledge of the industry and who certainly cannot be labeled an environmentalist or anti-corporatist. At the very least, the Obama administration or BP should either refute or confirm his claims. The silence on that could become the infamous dog that did not bark. On a positive note, the Obama administration did extend a moratorium on new offshore drilling permits, and the corporate media is finally beginning to report that the gusher in the Gulf is worse than BP and the feds have been telling people. Other than that, it is a nightmare for Gulf residents that just does not seem to end. Greg Payton writing at Orlando Independent Examiner. It's more than a nightmare for Gulf residents. I mean, I get his point, the writer's point, but Jesus, God. The plan to drill in the Arctic National, off the coast of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that Sarah Palin and the rest of these right-wing bastards have been pushing for, what, 20 years. President Obama said that he's suspending that. In response to Obama's press conference on actions he will take in response to the Gulf oil disaster, Brendan Cummings, who's senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, quote, while the decision to suspend Shell's planned drilling this summer in the Arctic is an important first step, what we really need is revocation of the improperly issued leases and permanent protection of the Arctic. The fact that no technology exists to effectively clean up an oil spill in Arctic waters will not be changed in a year's time. As the president recognized today, and the Gulf disaster has tragically demonstrated, even in areas with existing infrastructure and significant spill response assets, containment and response capability to a large oil spill is wholly inadequate. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar and the Obama administration should not pretend that a 6-month review of drilling procedures will change anything. Expanding offshore drilling to new areas needs to be permanently taken off the table. I have something, it's fairly long, but it is profoundly important piece that, yeah, here, well, I'll get to that in a second, but it was in the McClatchy newspapers. The Obama administration today will announce it will suspend planned exploratory oil drilling in the Arctic off Alaska until at least 2011. The move will stop Shell from drilling five wells in the Chukchi and Beaufort areas, or Beaufort seas, off northern Alaska weeks before it had hoped to start work. The move will stop for now a controversial expansion of oil drilling in a part of the world that could hold vast stores of oil and natural gas, but which environmentalists warn could come at great risk. Despite a late appeal from Shell that it would employ new safety measures, we will. Salazar was unconvinced that the exploratory drilling, even in the much shallower waters of the Arctic, would be safe. Shell, which paid $2.1 billion in 2008 for the leases, had planned to start exploratory drilling in June or July. The decision was met with a statement of deep unhappiness by U.S. Senator Mark Begich, from Alaska. Isn't he the Democrat? He said, quote, I am frustrated that this decision by the Obama administration to halt offshore development for a year will cause more delays and higher costs for domestic oil and gas production to meet the nation's energy needs. The Gulf of Mexico tragedy has highlighted the need for much stronger oversight and accountability of oil companies working offshore, but Shell has updated his plans and make significant investments to address the concerns raised by the Gulf spill. Whoa! Don't you just want to take these sons of bitches by the neck and just start squeezing? Huh? Don't you? Not him. You know what I'm talking about. Oh, Mike Malloy threatened a U.S. senator last night. No, ass jerks. That's not what I'm doing. You know what I'm talking about. This is a Malloy program. Got an email here from Hernan in Argentina. Mike, there's a Scandinavian paper company that installed its operation in Uruguay on the coast of the main river that divides that country with Argentina. There are hundreds of people that claim the company is poisoning the river, so they blocked the main national road. For 2 years, they are still there. This criminal murder of the Gulf of Mexico has little reaction from the American people, the media, and especially your government. How can that be? Is it possible that corporations have more power and will do and the will to harm than Americans to defend their lives and the lives of their children? Really a shame, Hernan. Yeah, that's pretty much gets it, Hernan. We have learned helplessness in this country. We sit back and watch the television and say, "Oh, Jesus, really? Oh no, look! Oh." I don't know. Kate points out that the migration of birds, when the birds head south this fall from Canada and places north, instead of stopping in the estuaries and the wetlands in the Louisiana coast, they will come back to their nests and die. John in Raleigh writes, Mike, would we not call this BP oil disaster climate change, or put another way, a major threat to Americans, the environment, the Gulf Coast economy, the employment? So why, if our government is so worried about climate change, did BP get safety and other waivers in the Deepwater Horizon drilling plan? If I read all this right, CO2 levels are a disaster waiting to happen. But for oil drilling, we just let the cowboys drill with no serious safety regulations. Keeping it safe. We hear this all the time from the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and other agencies as they collect their huge budgets. But when something happens, such as the BP oil volcano, Katrina, the Christmas Day bomber, we get nothing. And how about our open southern borders? Keeping us safe? Americans aren't safe. Yeah, I'm angry. John Raleigh. Joe in Oxford, Wisconsin. Mike, I saw President Obama today. As a friend of mine once said, in the face of dire circumstances, talk is cheap, MF-er. I'm envisioning a bleak future in which progressives abandoned the neo-corporate Obama talk is cheap agenda in 2012 in the hope that some of us might endure four more years of tribulation under the murderous hand of a right-wing corporate oligarch rule, with the hope that our courageous stand against mediocrity inspires support from the scattered earthbound populations who hold an indigenous vision of a future lived in harmony with the planet on which we rely for survival. Is 2016 too far a goal? How many of us wouldn't survive such a struggle? Only true change would be worth the price, and failure might doom us all. So what say you? Joe, Oxford, Wisconsin. 2016. I stop and think how old I'll be in 2016. I guess with a good scope and a good rifle, I could participate. Plus, I have a Hopi Indian friend who has promised me that I get the 50 caliber. I think he said I get the 50 caliber. I don't know. This talk is crazy. When I think about the lies and distortions that this filthy, putrid Glenn Beck has been spewing out for about 2 or 3 years now, especially where it concerns this administration, when I think of the lies and deception and distortion that this filthy, lard-ass Rush Limbaugh has been spewing out for two decades, right through his drug habits, his child molestations, everything, and this pig keeps doing it. And I think about this poor, miserable little jerk Sean Hannity, who continues to spew out whatever Fox News tells him to spew out. And I think about the millions of people who listen to this, and the millions of people who say that their primary news source, and they're proud of this, is the Fox News Channel. Fox News Channel's ratings are going up. CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC are going down. We need a cleansing in this country, don't we? So Arctic drilling will be suspended. On May 14th, Shell Oil sent a five-page letter to the Minerals Management Service spelling out how it plans to drill in Arctic waters, how it would prevent a spill, and how it would respond if there is one within an hour. Shell Oil President Marvin Odom told the MMS, quote, Shell is committed to undertaking a safe and environmentally responsible exploration program in the Chukchi Sea and Beaufort Sea in 2010. I am confident that we are ready to conduct the 2010 Arctic Exploratory Program safely. And I want to be clear, the accountability for this program rests with Shell. End quote. The plans included 9 new steps Shell has added since the Gulf of Mexico spill, including a policy of testing underwater equipment called the blowout preventer every 7 days instead of every 14. Woohoo! And developing a system to allow a remote operated vehicle to turn the blowout preventer back on. Woo! Odom said in his letter to federal regulators, quote, Shell will be ready to respond with oil spill response assets in 1 hour. Woohoo! He also argued that the brutal weather of the Arctic makes it easier to clean up an oil spill, not more difficult. He said, quote, Arctic conditions create differences in responding to oil in cold and ice conditions, differences in evaporation rates, viscosity, and weathering provide greater opportunities to recover oil. So that's his argument, you see. After they do F up and the Arctic is covered. This filthy bastard, Marvin Odom, has the temerity to say, oh, well, because it's cold up there, the oil will become more viscous and easier to grab globs of it and take it out of the sea. And we're supposed to sit back and go, oh, well, that makes sense. And that's what 46% of television viewers will do, because 46% of television viewers watch this putrid sewer Fox News every day. Oh, my God. Environmentalists countered that the harsh environment and the remoteness of the area could make any spill harder to handle, not easier. Oh, well, you bunch of left-wing hippie bastards, what are you talking about? Well, I'll tell you when we come back. The hour. All right, so the Natural Resources Defense Council, the director of the Alaska Project at the National Resource Defense Council, Chuck Clusen, says hazards present in the Arctic can include frigid temperatures, presence of sea ice, gale force winds, intense storms, and heavy fog. To date, no technology exists to clean up oil in sea ice conditions. Further, the cold water breaks down oil much slower than the warm Gulf waters. The potential for loss in the Arctic is great. In the meantime, the two senators Murkowski and this other freak are very upset because the Obama administration has suspended what Shell was going to do. I mean, I just don't get it. You know, I don't get it. What is wrong with those two senators? Well, we know it's wrong. Of course, they're owned outright. They are owned by the oil industry. Kay, our education affairs correspondent, sent this to me. Mike, I've been at a complete loss for words regarding the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, but today as I was filing away some of my old school materials, I came across the following. The last two sentences sum this tragedy up better than anything I've read or heard thus far. It's written by a holy woman of the Wintu tribe in 1876. Quote, "The white people never cared for land or deer or bear. When we Indians kill meat, we eat it all up. When we dig roots, we make little holes. When we build houses, we make little holes. When we burn grass for grasshoppers, we don't ruin things. We shake down acorns and pine nuts. We don't chop down the trees. But the white people plow up the ground, pull down trees, kill everything. How can the spirit of the earth like the white man? Everywhere the white man has touched it, it is sore." End quote. Over 100 years after these words were uttered, we still haven't learned a damn thing. Okay. Bernie Sanders today said that the United States must learn a profound lesson from the BP oil catastrophe in the Gulf, make certain we protect our oceans from future disasters, and transform our energy system away from fossil fuels. In light of that, Sanders introduced legislation that would ban offshore drilling along America's ocean coastlines and increase fuel efficiency in American cars. The measure would prohibit drilling in the Pacific and Atlantic oceans and along Florida's Gulf coastline. A moratorium on drilling in those areas that Congress approved every year since 1982 lapsed in 2008. Is that today? I don't know. And this is what really gets me. Is this from, I guess this is from the Times. Yeah, this is the article that got BP's bloomers in a wad. BP had to halt its ambitious effort to plug its stricken oil in the Gulf of Mexico on Thursday afternoon when engineers saw that too much of the drilling fluid they were injecting into the well was escaping, along with the leaking crude. No, they stopped. They stopped midnight Thursday. Last night. Midnight. You know, there's other stuff going on that is, I don't know, is it more serious than this? I understand this. I heard on some newscast that, or some conversation on radio or TV, I don't know which, there are questions being circulated now within the Obama administration as to whether or not we are prepared to enter into a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. The North Koreans have gone, they've been listening way too much Glenn Beck. They've gone absolutely insane. They have broken they've negated every agreement, every treaty, everything they have with the South. They are mobilizing their 10 million man or 5 million, whatever the hell it is, army. There are enough long-range cannon. Did we still use that term? Big guns on the north side of the 38th parallel to blow much of South Korea into non-existence, even without the use of nuclear weapons. And I will guarantee you that if an attack comes from the north to the south, The U.S. will use tactical nukes. Boom. Before you can say, kimchi, it'll happen. I'm telling you. And that, you know, that's going on. While we sit here and don't know what the hell we're doing, we'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, so things are getting a little tense here in the production facilities of the Malloy program. Subhankar Banerjee is a photographer. And he writes, bear with me, I'll get to the oil. But first you have to understand where I've been and where you undoubtedly won't go. But Shell's drilling rigs surely will, unless someone stops them. Over the last decade, I've come to know Arctic Alaska about as intimately as a photographer can. I've been there many times, starting with the 14 months I spent back in 2001-2002, crisscrossing the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. 4,000 miles in all seasons by foot, raft, kayak, and snowmobile, regularly accompanied by Inupiat hunter and conservationist Robert Thompson from Kaktovik, a community of about 300 on the Arctic coast, or with Gwich'in hunters and conservationists Charlie Swaney and Jimmy John from Arctic Village, a community of about 150 residents on the south side of the Brooks Range Mountains. In the winter of 2002, Robert and I camped for 29 days at the Canning River Delta along the Beaufort Sea coast to observe a polar bear den. It's hard even to describe the world we encountered. Only 4 calm days out of that near month. The rest of the time, a blizzard blew steadily, its winds reaching a top speed of 65 miles an hour, while the temperature hovered in the minus 40 degree range, bringing the wind chill factor down to something you'll never hear on your local weather report, minus 110 degrees. If that's too cold for you, believe me, it was way too cold for someone who grew up in Kolkata, India, even if we did observe the bear and her 2 cubs playing outside the den. During the summer months, you probably can't imagine the difficulty I had sleeping on the Alaskan Arctic tundra. The sun is up 24 hours a day, and a cacophony of calls from more than 180 species of birds converging there to nest and rear their young never ceases, day or night, quote, quote. Those birds come from all 49 other American states and 6 continents. And what they conduct in those brief months is a planetary celebration on an unimaginably epic scale, one that connects the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to just about every other place on Earth. When you hear the clicking sound of the hooves of the tens of thousands of caribou that also congregate on this great Arctic coastal plain to give birth to their young, some not far from where my tent was set up, you know that you're in a place that, in a global resource, you're in a place that is a global resource and does not deserve to be despoiled. Millions of Americans have come to know the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, even if at a distance, thanks to the massive media attention it got when the Bush administration indicated that one of its top energy priorities was to open it up to oil and gas development. Thanks to the efforts of environmental organizations, the Gwich'in Steering Committee, and activists from around the country, George W. Bush fortunately failed in his attempt to turn the refuge into an industrial wasteland. While significant numbers of Americans have indeed come to care for the Arctic refuge, they know very little about the Alaskan Arctic Ocean regions, the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, which the refuge abuts. I came to know these nearshore coastal areas better years later and discovered what the local Inupiats have known for millennia. These two Arctic seas are verdant ecological habitats for remarkable numbers of marine species, including endangered bowhead whales and threatened polar bears, beluga whales, walruses, various kinds of seals, and numerous species of fish and birds, not to mention the vast range of non-charismatic marine creatures we can't see, right down to the krill, tiny shrimp-like marine invertebrates that provide the food that makes much of this life possible. The Kasigaluk Lagoon, or Kasigaluk Lagoon, which I spent much time documenting as a photographer along the Chukchi Sea, is one of the most important coastal treasures of the entire circumpolar north. It is 125 miles long and only separated from the sea by a thin stretch of barrier islands. Five icy rivers drain into the lagoon, creating a nutrient-rich habitat for a host of species. An estimated 4,000 beluga whales are known to calve along its southern edge, and more than 2,000 spotted seals use the barrier islands as haul-out places in late summer, while 40,000 black-brant goose use its northern reaches as feeding grounds in the fall. In July 2006, during a late-evening walk, wildlife biologist Robert Suidam and I even spotted a couple of yellow wagtails. Not imposing whales, no, these were tiny songbirds. Still, the sight moved me. Did you know, I told my companion, that some of them migrate to the Arctic from my home, India? Unfortunately, as you've already guessed, I'm not here to tell you about all the glories and extremity of the Alaskan Arctic, which happens to be the most biologically diverse quadrant of the entire circumpolar north. I'm writing this piece because of the oil, because under all that life and beauty in the melting Arctic, there's something our industrial civilization wants, something oil companies have had their eyes on for a long time now. If you've been following the increasing ecological devastation unfolding before our collective eyes in the Gulf of Mexico since BP's Deepwater Horizon exploratory drilling rig went up in flames, then you should know about and protest Shell Oil's plan to begin exploratory oil drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas this summer. On March 31st, standing in front of an F-18 Green Hornet fighter jet and a large American flag at Andrews Air Force Base, President Obama announced a new energy proposal which would open up vast expanses of America's coastlines, including the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, to oil and gas development. Then on May 13th, the United States Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals handed a victory to Shell Oil. It rejected the claims of a group of environmental organizations and native Inupiat communities that had sued Shell and the Interior Department's Minerals Management Service to stop exploratory oil drilling in the Arctic Seas. Fortunately, Shell still needs air quality permits from the EPA, as well as final authorization from Interior Secretary Ken Salazar before the company can send its 514-foot drilling ship, Frontier Discoverer, north this summer to drill three exploratory wells in the Chukchi Sea and two in the Beaufort Sea. Given what should by now be obvious to all about the dangers of such deep water drilling, even in far less extreme climates, let's hope they don't get either the permits or the authorization. On May 14th, I called Robert Thompson, the current board chair of Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands, or Red Oil. "I'm very stressed right now," he told me. "We've been watching the development of BP's oil spill in the Gulf on television. We're praying for the animals and people there. We don't want Shell to be drilling in our Arctic waters this summer." As it happened, I was there when in August 2006, Shell's first small ship arrived in the Beaufort Sea. Robert's wife, Jane, caught it in her binoculars from her living room window, and I photographed it as it was scoping out the sea bottom in a near-shore area just outside Kaktovik. Its job was to prepare the way for a larger seismic ship due later that month. Since then, Robert has been asking one simple question. If there was a Gulf-like disaster, could spilled oil in the Arctic Ocean actually be cleaned up? He's asked it in numerous venues, at Shell's annual general meeting in The Hague in 2008, for instance, and at the Arctic Frontiers Conference in Tromsø, Norway, that same year. At Tromsø, Larry Persille, then associate director of the Washington office of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, and since December 2009, the federal natural gas pipeline coordinator in the Obama administration, Mr. Persille gave a 20-minute talk on the role oil revenue plays in Alaska's economy. During the question and answer period afterward, Robert typically asked, can oil be cleaned up in the Arctic Ocean? And if you can't answer yes, or if it can't be cleaned up, why are you involved in leasing this land? And I'd also like to know if there are any studies on oil toxicity in the Arctic Ocean, and how long will it take for the oil there to break down to where it's not harmful to our marine environment? Mr. Persille responded, I think everyone agrees that there is no good way to clean up oil from a spill in broken sea ice. I've not read anyone disagreeing with that statement, so you're correct on that. As far as why the federal government and the state government want to lease offshore, I'm not prepared to answer that. They're not my leases, to be real honest with everyone. More on this when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
America, one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
Photographer Subhankar Banerjee has a piece at Tom Dispatch that I'm quoting from. All right. He's referring to Shell's annual general meeting in The Hague in 2008. A month after that conference, Shell paid an unprecedented $2.1 billion to the MMS for oil leases in the Chukchi Sea. In October and December 2009, MMS approved Shell's plan to drill 5 exploratory wells. In the permitted issue, the MMS concluded that a large spill was, quote, too remote and speculative an occurrence, end quote, to warrant analysis, even though the agency acknowledged that such a spill could have devastating consequences in the Arctic Ocean's icy waters and could be difficult to clean up. It would be an irony of sorts that the only thing that stood between the Obama administration and an Arctic disaster in the making was BP's present catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico. This isn't the first time that America's Arctic seas have been exploited for oil. If you want to know more, check out John Bakstoshi's book, Whales, Ice, and Men, The History of Whaling in the Western Arctic. Throughout the latter part of the 19th century, commercial whalers regularly ventured into those seas to kill bowhead whales for whale oil, used as illuminant in lamps and as candle wax. It was also the finest lubricating oil then available for watches, clocks, chronometers, and other machinery. Later, after petroleum was discovered, whale baleen became a useful material for making women's corsets. In 1848, when the first New England whaling ship arrived in Alaska, an estimated 30,000 bowhead whales lived in those Arctic seas. Just 2 years later, there were 200 American whaling vessels plying those waters, and they had already harvested 1,700 bowheads. Within 50 years, an estimated 20,000 bowhead whales had been slaughtered. By 1921, commercial whaling of bowheads ended, as whale oil was no longer needed, and the worldwide population of bowheads had, in any case, declined to about 3,000, with the very survival of the species in question. Afterward, the bowhead population began to bounce back. Today, more than 10,000 bowheads and more than 60,000 beluga whales migrate through the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. The bowhead is believed to be, perhaps, the longest-lived mammal. It is now categorized as endangered under the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and receives additional protection under the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972. It would, of course, be unforgivably ironic if, having barely outlived the first Arctic oil rush, the species were to fall victim to the second. Inupiat communities have been hunting bowheads for more than two millennia for subsistence food. In recent decades, the International Whaling Commission has approved an annual quota of 67 whales for 9 Inupiat villages in Alaska. This subsistence harvest is deemed ecologically sustainable and not detrimental to the recovery of the whale population. My first experience of a bowhead hunt in Koktovik was in September 2001. After the whale was brought ashore, everyone, from infants to elders, gathered around the creature to offer a prayer to the Creator and thank the whale for giving itself up to and provided needed food for the community. The muktuk, the whale skin and blubber, was then shared among community members in 3 formal celebrations over the year to come: Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Nalukatuk, a June whaling feast, 2 of which I attended. In 2007, with writer Peter Mathiasen, I visited Point Hope and Point Lay, 2 Inupiat communities of about 1,000 inhabitants on the Chukchi Sea coast. Point Hope is considered one of the oldest continuously inhabited settlements in North America. At Point Lay, we accompanied Bill and Marie Tracy on a 17-hour boat ride during a beluga whale hunt. After the whales were beached, 4 generations gathered in a circle to offer prayer and thanks to the whales. In other words, for such Alaskan Inupiat communities, whales are far more than food on the table. Their cultural and spiritual identity is inextricably linked to the whales and the sea. If Shell Oil's vessels head north, the question is, how long will these communities survive? And it's not just whales and the communities that live off them that are at stake. Oil drilling, even at a distance, has already taken a toll in the Arctic. After all, the survival of several Arctic species, including polar bears, walruses, seals, and seabirds, is seriously threatened by the widespread melting of sea ice, the result of climate change, caused, of course, by the use of fossil fuels. In 2008, the U.S. Department of Interior listed the polar bear as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. In addition, millions of birds use the nearshore Arctic waters, barrier islands, coastal lagoons, and river deltas for nesting and rearing their young in spring and for feeding in summer before they start migrating to their southern wintering grounds. When the Arctic wind blows in one direction, nutrient-rich fresh water from the rivers is pushed out into the ocean. When it blows in the other direction, salt water from the sea enters the lagoon. This mixing of fresh and salt water creates a nutrient-rich nearshore ecological habitat for birds, many species of fish, and several species of seals. All this is my way of saying that if oil drilling begins in the Arctic seas and anything goes wrong, the nature of the disaster in the calving, nesting, and spawning grounds of so many creatures would be hard to grasp. There's more. We'll finish this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. I'm sharing with you something written by Subhankar Banerjee, who is a photographer of note. And he's writing about the time that he spent in that part of the Arctic and Alaska that Shell Oil wants to begin exploratory drilling. Shell Oil was given permission to begin this drilling. They were sued by environmental groups and indigenous people in the area who said, no, you can't you can't do this. But an appeals court overturned the lower court ruling and said, go ahead. Yes, you can. And on March 31st, Barack Obama announced his new energy proposal, which included oil exploration in the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea areas, in the very area that this photographer is talking about. As of today, I think today, it's my understanding that Obama and Salazar have issued a temporary hold on those permits to begin drilling in the Arctic. But the holds are temporary. A year, 6 months, whatever it is. Back to this essay. With the crisis in the Gulf of Mexico ongoing, scientists are beginning to worry about hurricane season. It officially begins on June 1st and doesn't officially end until November 30th. Any significant storm entering the Gulf would, of course, only exacerbate the disaster, moving oil all over the place while hindering cleanup operations. Now, think about the Arctic Ocean, where blizzards and storms aren't seasonal events, but an all-year-round reality, and thanks, many scientists believe, to the effects of climate change, their intensity is actually on the rise. Even in summer, they can blow in at 80 miles an hour, bringing any oil spill on the high seas very quickly into ecologically rich coastal areas. On May 5th, Native Village of Point Hope and the environmental organization Red Oil joined 14 environmental organizations in sending a letter to Interior Secretary Salazar. In light of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, it urges him to reconsider his decision to allow Shell to proceed with its drilling plan. That same week, Secretary Salazar did finally order a halt to all new offshore drilling projects and asked Shell to explain how it could improve its ability to prevent a spill, and if one happens, to respond to it effectively in the Arctic. On May 18th, Shell responded publicly that it would employ a pre-made dome to contain any leaking well and deploy chemical dispersants underwater at the source of any oil leak. From what I gather, both methods have been attempted by BP in the Gulf of Mexico. The dome has so far failed, developing hydrates and becoming unusable before ever being placed over the leak. Scientists now believe that those toxic chemical dispersants have resulted in significant ecological devastation to coral reefs and could be dangerous to other sea life. None of this bodes well for the Arctic. There is, I'm beginning to realize, another crisis we have to face in the Gulf, the Arctic, and elsewhere. How do we talk about and show what we can't see? Yes, via video, we can see the gushing oil at the source of BP's well a mile below the surface of the water. And thanks to television and newspapers, we can sometimes see or read about oil-slicked dead birds, dead sea turtles, and dead dolphins washing up on coastlines. But what about all the other aspects of life underwater that we can't see, that won't simply wash up on some beach, that in terms of our daily lives might as well be on Mars? What's happening to the incredible diversity of marine life inhabiting that mile-deep water? And what cumulative impact will all that still spilling oil have on it, on the ecology of the Gulf of Mexico, and possibly, in ways we are not yet able to imagine, on our lives? These are questions that desperately need to be asked and answered before we allow oil ships to head north and drilling to spread to America's Arctic Ocean. Keep in mind that there, unlike in the temperate and tropical zones where things grow relatively fast, in the Arctic, everything grows very slowly. On the other hand, toxins left behind from oil spills will take far longer to break down in the frigid climate. Bad as the Gulf disaster may be, a damaged Arctic will take far more time to heal. Whatever we can't see, what we already can see on the front pages of our newspapers and in the TV news should be more than enough to convince us not to take it seriously, the safety claims of giant oil companies desperate to drill under some of the worst conditions imaginable. Send those drill rigs into Arctic waters, and sooner or later, you know just what you'll get. If the remaining permits are approved for Shell in the coming weeks, the Frontier Discoverer will be in the Chukchi Sea less than 6 weeks later. President Obama and Secretary Salazar should stop this folly now. It's important for them to listen to those who really know what's at stake, the environmental groups and human rights organizations of the indigenous Inupiat communities. It's time to put a stop to Shell's drilling plan in America's Arctic Ocean for this summer and all the summers to come. Savankar Banerjee is a photographer, writer, and activist. His first book, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land, is received international media attention because an accompanying exhibition at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History was censored in the Bush years. Censored. So, it was announced today that George W. Bush, I guess it might as well be, huh? That Barack Obama has decided to issue a temporary halt to taking the same kind of apparatus and equipment and risk into the Arctic. This really is madness, you know? I mean, the whole thing. What is happening in the Gulf? Remember when this started about 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago? Remember, oh, look, an oil rig caught on fire and burned. Oh my God, 11 people were killed. Good Lord. I wonder what happened. And then the next day and the day after, there's a leak down there. Everything that BP has said has been a filthy lie. It's been misdirection. This is what capitalism does. This is what corporatism does. There is no need to tell the truth because they're not involved in truth. And their sole purpose is to keep truth from the people and resources that they are exploiting. And even when the truth gets out there, we finally reached a point in this country and a lot of other countries of learned helplessness. Well, there's nothing I can do about it. Oh, God, that's awful. It's going to eat up the Gulf. Well, Jesus, we go up here to Lake Lanier, so I don't know. Maybe I guess those people down there will just have to get different jobs. Yeah, that's a shame. Nothing I can do about it. I got too many other things to worry about. You know, you think the president would do something about this. Nah, what does he do? He goes to those damn parties.
Time.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. North Korea has said it is scrapping a 2004 accord aimed at preventing accidental armed clashes with South Korea. As tensions continue to rise with the sinking of a warship, I was 8 years old when it was a Sunday in the summer. It was July or August. I think I had just turned 8. And I was visiting my grandparents for the summer. And it was late afternoon, maybe 5 o'clock, 5:30, and we were getting ready to go to church. And I remember it for the Sunday evening services at the Baptist Church in downtown Findlay, Ohio. And it was hot. It was always hot at my grandma's because, you know, they had a big old house with no air conditioning. And nobody had air conditioning. Are you kidding me? This was in Findlay, Ohio. And my uncle, Victorio, Uncle Vic, who had been severely wounded in Europe during World War II, his leg had been crushed or something. It was messed up pretty badly. And he came limping into the house. That's the way he walked for the last 30, 40 years of his life. He had a horrific limp that made his body move from side to side when he walked. And he came rushing, as best as he could rush, into the house. And he said to my grandparents, "The communists have attacked South Korea." I didn't know what a communist was, didn't know what South Korea was. And my grandparents, immigrants, who had not that long ago experienced the end of World War II, became visibly upset. I can remember that. And we went on to church, and I remember this, the preacher standing up to that night, and his sermon was based on what he called one of the most serious events to occur since World War II has occurred tonight. And of course, it all scared the hell out of me. And I asked my grandma and my grandpa's car. He had a 36 Ford. And as we drove home that night after church service, I said, "Where's Korea?" And my grandmother said, "It's way far away. You don't have to worry about any of this." And my God, that was... that was decades ago. So now, I'm watching news today. North and South Korea are getting ready to go to war. In a notice to the South's armed forces today, the North's General Chiefs of Staff warned of an immediate attack if South Korea violates the disputed Yellow Sea border. North Korea also said that it will ban South Korean personnel and vehicles from entering a joint industrial park at the North Korean border town of Kaesong. Meanwhile, a fleet of South Korean warships fired artillery and dropped anti-submarine bombs in a large-scale military exercise off the west coast of the country. In Seoul, the South Korean capital, tens of thousands of people gathered to protest against the North. The developments come amid tensions on the divided peninsula that have arisen since a team of international investigators said last week that a torpedo fired by a North Korean sub tore apart and sank a South Korean warship on March 26, killing 46 sailors. The North accused South Korea's government of falsely blaming it for the sinking, partly to help the ruling party in local elections due to be held next week. "That's why you're blaming us." Hillary Clinton, during a visit to South Korea yesterday, called on the international community to issue a strong response to the sinking of the ship. Yada, 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 yada. And I said, I've heard rumors circulating that we may get involved in a nuclear war. It'd be very quick. tactical newts. Prairie 2 says, no, might not be necessary to use nukes. One legitimate use for cluster munitions is to take out artillery tubes. With modern radar, any tube that fires, even if they have eluded the satellites, will be identified before the gun's recoil is over. U.S. intermediate range missiles located well out of range could respond before another round is loaded. A mixed load of bomblets would take out the gun, the crew, and make the area unapproachable. Korea is quite narrow at that point, and it would not be possible to hide. They can lay mines in the same way in front of any advancing troops. North Korea is still using 1960 technology. It will be a short war. Well, that's reassuring.
It is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. As you know, Bob Kincaid's program, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, webcast, follows this program's webcast, courtesy White Rose Society. Most of you know that. And Bob Kincaid, who is the host of Head on Radio Network, in response to an inquiry from one of our mutual friends, sent this back to her, and she has forwarded it on to me. It says, it adds a bit of perspective and maybe hope to recognize these events are not unique to us or our age. It is a human curse that arises, I think, from our relatively short lifespans. What would a 200-year-old parrot or a 500-year-old tortoise tell us? As you consider it all, consider the words of William Wordsworth from the early 19th century. The title is, World is Too Much With Us. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we're out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. And C.L. writes, when I think of what's going on, the end of 3 days of the Condor comes to mind. Higgins. It's simple economics. Today it's oil, right? In 10 or 15 years, food, plutonium, maybe even sooner. Now, what do you think the people are going to want us to do then? Joe Turner. Ask them? Higgins. Not now. Then. Ask them when they're running out. Ask them when there's no heat in their homes and they're cold. Ask them when their engines stop. Ask them when people who have never known hunger start going hungry. You want to know something? They won't want us to ask them. They'll just want us to get it for them. From Bob in Coos Bay, Mike, I think you recently brought up the fact that there had been little or no mention of those who lost their lives on the oil rig explosion. Interestingly enough, I've only seen one person put up the photos and list the names of the dead workers, and that was Lawrence O'Donnell one day last week when he was filling in for one of the regulars on MSNBC. Yeah, that's something that O'Donnell would do. Greg in Florida, whose piece I read earlier tonight, Mike, a real marine biologist just called from Madison, Wisconsin to say she heard that piece on the mic, 92.1. She also said, there's a perfect storm brewing in the Gulf. The methane gas will raise air temps, and the dark, light-absorbing sheen on the water will increase the water temperature. Storms feed on that. Meanwhile, El Nino has taken its normal shift like it did in 2005. It is no coincidence that oceanographic research institutes, such as the one at Colorado State University, have upped their hurricane predictions for this year. You will see the official federal predictions upped as well. We're looking at about 15 storms this year, eight of which will be named, and a Category 5 is not out of the realm of possibility this year. The predictions may even go higher. I think it's time to get the blank out of Florida and head back up north. Greg in Florida, yeah. Probably a good idea. Diana writes, Mike, today at his news conference, the president referred to the ocean as sacred. I cannot imagine, and I have a good imagination, any Republican referring to anything on this planet as sacred. Okay, maybe an unborn fetus is sacred, but hey, once it's born, baby, you're on your own. Diana. William from Hollywood. Listening to the presser today, one thing came to mind. So we now find out the hard way. With this BP oil disaster, it is not such a great idea to drill into the ocean floor. Did we really learn? But what struck me is, what about mining for coal? And the almost zero talk about that. Then bring in nuke-powered power plants. Are we to once again find out the hard way? No one knows how to clean up the oil. And the same applies to the coal tailings. And what about cleaning up nuclear spent fuel when it explodes? I haven't heard of one way to deal with any of these pending disasters. William from Hollywood. Yeah, we sure do make a mess, don't we? Huh? Oh, yeah, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but Energy Secretary Stephen Chu from MotherJones.com, Josh Harkinson brings up, asks a question, is Stephen Chu too cozy with BP? The oil spill is casting a spotlight on the Energy Secretary's close ties with the oil company, which funded BP, funded the Energy Biosciences Institute at UC Berkeley, that Chu founded a year before he joined the Department of Energy. BP's decision to underwrite Chu's institute with a $500 million grant was made by BP's chief scientist, Stephen Koonin, whom Chu last year named his Department of Energy Undersecretary for Science. Jesus, God. Jennifer Washburn, the author of a forthcoming Center for American Progress report called Big Oil Goes to College, told the New York Times, quote, the fact that Stephen Chu selected Steve Koonin, BP's chief scientist, to be his undersecretary would predispose them to think that they could maybe negotiate with BP, could be more like partners regarding the oil cleanup. End quote. While the Department of Energy doesn't have jurisdiction over the spill, 150 people at its national laboratories have been working on it, and some consumer watchdogs have accused the department of reacting too slowly. Chu also has been an optimist regarding the cleanup and containment efforts, telling reporters 2 weeks ago that, quote, things are looking up, end quote. And Josh Harkinson writes that in late 2008, just after Obama appointed Chu to the Energy Secretary post, I explored his ties to BP and speculated on how they might influence him. For now, at least, it remains unclear to what extent Chu has given BP favorable treatment, either in terms of crafting the Department of Energy's research agenda or its response to the oil spill. But what's clear is that the close ties are casting a shadow over the agency, sowing doubt among the public that the government is truly an independent watchdog. The same concerns were raised by UC Berkeley professors regarding the Energy Bioscience Institute. Yada, yada, yada. Isn't it interesting for us former Obama supporters, for me it was by default. Of course, I shouldn't have been a coward. I should have voted green, which I will damn sure do for the rest of my life. But isn't it interesting? All the Goldman Sachs people, the biggest finance industry predators in the history of the human race, chock-a-block in the Obama administration. Big oil, chock-a-block in the Obama administration. Telecom, chock-a-block in the Obama administration. Corporate America, capitalist America, has the Obama administration stretched out on a cross with nails in the hands, the feet, and a sword stuck into his side. They're crucifying Obama. And Kathy asked me today, do you think that Obama is naive? And the immediate answer, you know, the Buddhist reply, the first answer is the best answer. The immediate answer was yes. Yes, he is naive. I mean, how long ago was it? 7 weeks ago, right before this massive event occurred in the Gulf, that Obama was talking about his new energy policy would include more offshore and Arctic drilling. Did he not know at the time? Now, he mentioned today about the corruption left behind by the Bush crime family. He didn't use those terms, but you heard what he said. Very cautiously dances around the turn. Well, you know, a lot of this stuff was left in place for me to deal with. You're damn right it was, Mr. President. Is he naive? Or worse? Before the hour, Washington Business Journal. The Aransas National Wildlife Refuge and the Padre Island National Seashore among two of the areas most at risk from the BP oil spill. This is in Texas. The National Resources Defense Council and the Rocky Mountain Climate Organization released a report highlighting the 15 national parks, wildlife refuges, and state parks in Gulf states that are most threatened by the spill. Aransas National Wildlife Refuge is managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. President Franklin Roosevelt designated these 115,000 acres of sensitive land as a place where migratory birds could rest and breed. The Padre Island National Seashore consists of federally protected beachfront property. The 70-mile stretch of land is home to migratory birds and serves as a nesting ground for sea turtles. Theo Spencer, senior advocate of the Climate Center at the National Resources Defense Council of Washington, D.C., said, quote, this could become America's greatest environmental disaster. Oil contamination from the explosion of BP's rig threatens precious natural resources and livelihoods across the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. So, Texas wildlife threatened by BP spill. That's not all. That's the San Antonio Business Journal. This is the Washington Business Journal. The Virginia governor's office has responded to Barack Obama's decision to cancel oil drilling off Virginia's coast with disappointment. Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling in a statement said, quote, I remain convinced that offshore energy development, see, they don't say drilling now. Offshore energy development can occur safely, and I do not believe that we should abandon or postpone responsible efforts. The president's decision will deprive Virginia of the economic resources and jobs that could be created as a result of offshore energy development. See, they don't say drilling. Bowling called the decision extremely disappointing and vowed to continue advancing exploration and development of Virginia's offshore drilling potential. You see, today, Obama canceled the proposed lease sale off the coast of Virginia, as well as suspending planned exploration off the coast of Alaska, and extended a moratorium on deep water drilling permits for another 6 months. Well, he's just costing us jobs. You know what he wants to do? He wants to take over the oil industry. That's what he wants to do. Jesus, God. Paul writes, Mike, Obama's fast becoming everything he campaigned against, and you ask if he's naive? Paul. Yeah, I just wonder to what, I don't think it's a question of whether or not the President of the United States is naive about the way things work in corporate America and capitalist America. I think for a young man like Barack Obama, it's just all been overwhelming. I think his intentions were not to lead the country into chaos. I know. I'm going to piss off everybody who says, hey, are you kidding? Come on. Would that he were a socialist. Would that he were a democratic socialist, not a totalitarian socialist like Glenn Beck would like to be, but a democratic socialist. But he's not. He's not that at all. As much as the teabaggers don't have a clue as to what socialism is, nor does Glenn Beck or the rest of these rat bastards who continue to corrupt the country and try to destroy it. This is what Limbaugh and the rest of the pigs have been hoping and praying to their degenerate God for a long time. A massive disaster like this. Remember how much they enjoyed the events that surrounded the tragedy of Katrina? Remember? Surely you remember. You remember all the mockery that came out of the pig man's mouth? Remember? They love stuff like this. And Beck, who apparently when Limbaugh was having a bad case of dysentery, all of a sudden Beck appeared. And he wants to take it one step, well, not one step further, one step to the side. Beck wants to see Americans killing each other. Limbaugh wants to see disaster after disaster. And as far as what Kathy said earlier tonight, you know, maybe some of that oil will wash up near his multi-million dollar beachfront home in Palm Beach. He wouldn't care. He just set fire to it and move someplace else. He didn't care. When you're making $50 million a year and you have a 5-year or 10-year contract, what, a beachfront house? Doesn't mean a thing. Doesn't mean a thing. You move. Set fire to it. Walk away. Doesn't mean a thing. But that's what, this is what they wanted. This is what they have lusted after. So that they could then say, this is what Obama wanted. He wanted a big disaster like this. Yes, he did. Besides, with all the environmental crap, it's his fault. Driving all the drilling offshore, making them go way out there in the ocean where this would happen. These are sick bastards, they really are. Think we'll be here tomorrow night? If we are, I'll see you then. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.